This is crunch time for the 2018 campaign. Election day, November 6th, is nearly close enough for meteorologists to begin forecasting its weather. Welcome to Maine's Political Pulse with Mal Leary and Steve Missler. I'm Erwin Kratz. For voters, if they haven't already cast their absentee ballots, the time they're likely paying attention to political news and the flood of ads and stuff they're getting in the mail and on their social media feeds as they decide which candidates to vote for and whether to approve the various bond issues and other items they'll find on their ballots. For the candidates seeking office, they're now looking to one critical subset of Mainers.
This is a critical time to communicate with voters, the persuadable ones.
And the most persuadable ones are likely the people who tell pollsters they're undecided. And polls say in some races the undecided vote is still in double digits. History shows others may be persuadable too. The gubernatorial candidacies of Jim Longley in 1974 and Angus King in 1992 both rode late waves of enthusiasm that crested in the last 2 weeks of the campaign and deposited them in the Blaine House. Elliot Cutler nearly repeated the feat in 2010, moving from 14% support in a mid-October poll to 36% support on Election Day. Pollsters say voters in the 1991 referendum on widening the Maine Turnpike turned against the plan in the last week after an effective TV ad launched by the opposition. So this week is all about the undecided voters. Coming up, we'll take a close look at what candidates are doing to capture that vote, discuss the evolving nature of ranked choice voting's potential influence on certain races, and try to parse out one candidate's inconsistent messaging.
I've seen some really weird posts from him.
Mal Leary, who says now is the time candidates look out from their support base to see who's left to attract.
I think we're going to see them starting to try to focus on those undecided voters. There's a considerable number, depending on which public opinion poll you look at, so there's a lot of voters that could be shifted to one candidate or another. So I think we're going to start seeing more targeted ads to try to bring those folks to the polls. Layered on top of that, all of that, is the traditional get-out-the-vote efforts. We're seeing record numbers of absentee ballots already being requested. What was amazing to me was one-fifth of all the ballots that were cast in the 2016 presidential race were cast in the last 2 weeks by absentee ballots.
And the other thing to add to this is that there's still room for the surprise, the late ads that come in and they drop something very controversial.
Steve, independent gubernatorial candidate Alan Caron wrote last March, if he didn't think he could win, he would withdraw by mid-October. Well, it's now late October. The polls show him way behind. Any sign he's going to get out?
Well, not any public sign. What his campaign has said to me and others is that there's been no decision made. But I would expect, and I'm hearing, that a decision will be made very soon. There are a couple of big debates left, including ours on Sunday. What I've observed is that Alan Caron seems to be enjoying these debates, that, you know, he's sort of holding court. And I think maybe he's waiting for those to conclude before he makes his announcement. Now, it'll be interesting to see how Alan Caron gets out of the race. Does he simply withdraw from the race, or does he throw his support behind Janet Mills?
Now, there's the other independent in the race, Terry Hayes, who was a Democrat turned independent. Why is she still hanging on at this point?
She's in it for the long haul, as she puts it. She believes there's still a path by which she can get the votes to win this race. And quite frankly, looking at the way the numbers are in the polls, I don't see that. But as long as she is seeing that path, I don't think you're going to see her even begin to think about dropping out of the race. And it's going to be interesting to see the message she tries to craft in these final days to get at those undecided voters that they should consider her as an independent when she's so far down in the polls.
One thing that we saw back in the most recent campaign finance report is that Terry Hayes had $200,000 left cash on hand. Now, I've checked with the Maine Ethics Commission because she's running as a publicly financed candidate, and she has received an additional disbursement, a supplemental disbursement under that program of $175,000. But if you go and you look at the FCC reports, which tells you what candidates and campaigns are spending on television ads, Terry Hayes has not been on television since October 2nd. This is a critical time to communicate with voters that Mal was talking about, in particular, the persuadable ones. The question is, does she have the resources to get her message out in the final stretch of the campaign? In terms of television, her campaign tells me that she's week to week.
Steve, in a report that you did for us this week, you had a story that featured this quote from Lewiston City Clerk Kathy Monteo about voters who are casting their ranked choice voting ballots for Congress.
You know, they kind of lean out of the booth and say, hey, how come I can't do this for governor?
Of course, the answer is the courts say it violates the Maine Constitution. But I wonder, is there evidence ranked choice voting is gaining support in some quarters?
Well, we haven't seen anything to suggest that. But what we've learned just from talking to election officials is that people are wondering why they can't vote using this system for governor. I mean, the big part of the campaign 2 years ago by ranked choice voting supporters was that it was going to eliminate this so-called spoiler effect. And in the race for governor, this is very much in play, the split vote factor, especially if Terry Hayes remains in the race, which I fully expect her to do. And it's something that was the advocates of ranked choice voting said ranked choice voting would prevent. And what's interesting, too, is that the very people that were supporting ranked choice voting 2 years ago are also key operators of Terry Hayes's campaign. And so they're at this very moment in a position where ranked choice voting is not in play. And some people are questioning that. Why not? Why isn't it? And then you also have a candidate who could very well carry out the same thing that happened in 2010, which helped Governor Paul LePage in his first victory.
I think the whole future of ranked choice voting could hinge on the fact that it is being used in the congressional races. I think it's pretty clear that Bruce Poliquin, if he wins the plurality but then loses because of ranked choice voting, is not going to stand around and say, oh, gee, I lost. Yeah, he's going to take it to court on the constitutional questions that have yet to have been looked at by the courts.
All right. In the U.S. Senate race, it had looked like independent Angus King's major competitor would be Republican State Senator Eric Brakey. Brakey is now changing some positions. Do you think, gentlemen, he's getting desperate, Mal?
I'm not sure if I would use the word desperate, but I've seen some really weird posts from him on both Twitter and in press release form. Trying to portray Angus King as something he clearly is not. Well, I think the most recent one was Open Borders Angus, as if King was going to allow any immigrant to come into the country who wants to come into the country. That is clearly not his position. He stated that several times. So I'm not sure what Eric Brakey's up to. I haven't seen him up on the air yet, but I have seen Zach Ringelstein up on the air, who was doing a pretty good ad, you know, portraying who he is, why he's running, and at the very end brings up ranked choice voting.
Right, yeah.
Saying, vote for me first, but vote for Angus second.
That's right. Yeah, it's really interesting to see what's happened with Eric Brakey, because if you go back 2 years ago, he was a delegate who was basically, he told anybody who would listen that he was not going to vote for President Trump, that he could not support him in good conscience. The whole reason he had a primary challenger for a few weeks was the fact that he didn't support Trump. You know, Max Lynn, the whole reason why he came out and challenged Brakey was because Brakey was anti-Trump. And here he is now sort of adopting a lot of the rhetoric that Trump advocates have put out, which is a lot of focus on immigration. It's really bizarre. I mean, he had a tweet the other day where he was talking about, you know, suspected ISIS terrorists being in this caravan that's going through Central America right now. It's false. It's not true. The 100 suspected ISIS terrorists were arrested in Guatemala before the caravan even formed. They weren't in the caravan. They're not there now. But this is the type of stuff that he's been rolling out recently, which is really perplexing. I mean, this Eric Brakey rose to prominence and his state Senate seat as a libertarian. And I remember just a few years ago, there was this massive 75-car pileup just outside of Bangor. And 2 days later, Eric Brakey had a bill where he wanted to abolish Maine's seatbelt law. Well, Eric Brakey went to that public hearing, and some would arguably say that that took some guts to still go through with a public hearing to abolish the seatbelt law when this 75 car pileup was just is in the rear view mirror of the news. What he's doing now seems a lot different than that. I mean, I understand that he probably needs Trump's support to get a lot of people out to vote for him, but this is a sharp turn for him, and it's a bit perplexing to me.
And if you look at the public polling that is available to us, it doesn't seem to be giving him much traction. He doesn't seem to be holding the Republican base, let alone cutting into independents and Democrats he would need in order to actually get elected.
For 1 minute, to go back to the Democrat in the race, Zach Ringelstein, he was also featured in the lead national story in Tuesday's New York Times, placed him among a broader group of candidates challenging some fundamentals of U.S. economics. Is that likely to help him?
It's helped other candidates in other races. The challenge for Zach Ringelstein is that he's run a campaign that doesn't have the same financial horsepower and other aspects that have helped drive out Democratic Socialist candidates in other states. Now, at the same time, he does have a couple of things working in his favor, which is that he's young and he seems to be really going after that youth vote. And that, if the youth vote actually turns out in a midterm election, which would be an odd thing, frankly, because they usually don't, that might help him. And he might actually do better than a lot of people expected him to do.
Our political reporters, Mal Leary and Steve Missler. I'm Erwin Gratz. That's Maine's Political Pulse for this week. Have questions about any other races? Give us a shout on Twitter or through the Maine public website. We'd love to hear from you and what you want to know for next week's episode. If you like this episode, check out our earlier analysis. The earlier episodes examined everything from the sleepy tone of the governor's race to the near brawl up in the 2nd District. We don't just discuss what's happening, but why the candidates do what they do and how their campaigns got there. You can find abbreviated versions of Maine's Political Pulse on Friday's Morning Edition program from Maine Public Radio, and keep an eye out for short updates that may be posted throughout the week. Our producer is Willis Ryder Arnold. Music is from Rob Holt. For Maine Public, I'm Erwin Gratz.